Hello, and welcome to Science World. This coming Wednesday marks the 45th anniversary of the launch of the Apollo 11, the mission that put the first humans on the moon. This feat was the climax of an incredibly fierce competition between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union. We'll take a look back at what became known as the Space Race. By the time the international whaling moratorium went into effect in 1986, the commercial whaling industry had nearly wiped out the world's whale population. Since then, the population of whales has made a comeback, and we'll find the ways the whale population is serving to improve the ocean environment. And scientists recently published a long-term study that shows the impact climate change is having on the food supply of marine life in the West Antarctic Peninsula. We'll talk about what the scientists learned from their nearly 20-year research project with its lead author on today's one-on-one segment. These stories and more are coming your way on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. 45 years ago, two U.S. astronauts became the first humans to step on the moon. This remarkable achievement was the culmination of a fierce competition in space technology between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union. In a report by George Putich, Philip Alexio gives us a look back at the space race.
The space race began in the 1950s during the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, so it was as much about politics as science, says former cosmonaut and deputy director of the Memorial Museum of Cosmonauts, Alexander Levakin.
There was a big competition between us and America. Who will launch the first space satellite? It turned out we were the first ones.
That first man-made satellite, Sputnik, a 58-centimeter metal ball with four antennas that circled the globe and transmitted a simple signal, was a bitter pill for the American public. Less than 5 months later, in January 1958, the U.S. launched its first satellite, Explorer 1, which discovered the Van Allen radiation belt. But the Soviets pulled ahead again in April 1961, when the first cosmonaut, Yuri Gagarin, took a single swing around the planet. He returned to a hero's welcome. 1 month later, the first American astronaut, Alan Shepard, reached suborbital altitude and parachuted back to Earth. Growing public and political pressure prompted then-President John Kennedy to set America's sights higher, to land on the moon, says National Air and Space Museum curator Kathleen Lewis.
On the United States side, I think there's a bit of hubris that we can do anything better.
Before the decade was over, on July 20th, 1969, American Neil Armstrong became the first human being to walk on the moon. In the years that followed, the space race slowed and moved toward cooperation when in 1975, Washington and Moscow conducted the first manned rendezvous in space. The task of building the International Space Station, the demise of communism, and NASA's decision to retire its fleet of space shuttles ended the rivalry, says space curator at London Science Museum, Doug Millard.
So perhaps it was inevitable that things would not be repeated like that in the future, and indeed that's what it's turned out to be.
The current earthbound rivalry between the U.S. and Russia do not seem to affect the cooperation in space, says National Air and Space Museum's Kathleen Lewis.
You don't want to be arguing politics when you're up in a tin can 200 and some miles above Earth. You got nowhere to go, so you've got to focus on things that you can agree on and avoid the things that you might have disagreements on.
At the moment, the two space agencies do not have plans for greater cooperation, but their competitive space race is definitely a thing of the past. For George Putich, I'm Philip Alexio.
Back in the 19th and 20th centuries, commercial whaling killed tens of thousands of the giant marine mammals. By 1986, when an international moratorium was enacted, whale populations had dropped by about 66 to 90%. Today, however, whale populations are on the rebound. And as Roseanne Scoble reports, the increase in whale numbers is also improving the ocean environment.
Great whales are the largest animals in the history of life on Earth. You might know them by their names, baleen, sperm, humpback, blue, and gray. Valued for their meat and oil, they were once considered of little consequence to the ocean. But we know better now, says University of Vermont conservation biologist Joe Roman, lead author of a new study in the journal Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment. It finds that great whales have a powerful and positive impact on how the ocean works. He spoke via Skype.
They can increase nutrients in areas where they're feeding. So whales dive deep to feed. They come to the surface. And as it turns out, they defecate or they release whale poop at the surface. That has lots of nitrogen and other nutrients. So it can increase productivity in the areas where whales are feeding.
Whales continue to service the ocean, even when they die and sink to the deep sea, Roman says. After centuries of decline, great whales are steadily repopulating their historic breeding and feeding grounds, and they have a healthy appetite. Some commercial fisheries argue the whales are eating too many other fish and taking a big bite from their profits. Roman says the opposite is true.
I think that the classic view was too many whales, not enough fish. But our study and several others are starting to show that it's far more complicated, more interesting than that. That is, when whales are in a healthy ecosystem, we can have more fish and more whales at the same time.
But even as whales rebound, they are not immune to human threats in the ocean. They are run over by container ships, caught in fishing nets, and disturbed by noise from ocean traffic and sonar signals. Margaret Williams, who directs the World Wildlife Fund's Arctic program, spoke via Skype.
So shipping is increasing in the Arctic. Plans for offshore oil and gas development are increasing. And so World Wildlife Fund is working with government and communities and industry and other conservation groups to identify those areas that are very, very important for whale species, for migration areas, for feeding areas, and we're recommending that those areas receive special management attention.
William says whales deserve this protection. They are, as the study underscores, more valuable than whalers ever imagined to us, to fisheries, and to the ocean itself. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Children are becoming sick with tuberculosis at a much higher rate than previously estimated, according to a new study. As Steve Barragona reports, this new study presents the first-ever estimate of the scope of new TB infections among children, nearly 8 million in 2010.
Hard data are hard to come by, but the World Health Organization's best guess was that around 500,000 children worldwide developed tuberculosis in 2011. The WHO calculated that figure based on cases reported to health authorities, but many cases go unreported. Plus, TB in children is notoriously hard to diagnose. So pediatrician James Seddon at Imperial College London and his colleagues decided to take a different route.
There are lots of studies to say the vast majority of children who get TB who are young get it from someone in their family.
Starting with that family connection, Seddon's group used mathematical models to calculate how many children were likely to live with someone with tuberculosis, how many of those children become infected, and how many become ill. The researchers focused on the group of countries that account for 80% of the world's TB. They came up with an estimate of 650,000 new illnesses in those countries in 2010, more than the WHO's estimate for the entire world. The results are published in the medical journal The Lancet. Even more surprising, Seddon said, were the 15 million children living with a person with TB and the 7.6 million newly infected children.
We would hope that these numbers do strengthen the argument for saying to national programs, look, you've got a lot of children in your country who are infected with TB, and if they're not identified and given preventive treatment, this is going to be a problem that is not going to go away in the future.
Infectious Diseases Dr. Jennifer Furin at Case Western Reserve University, who is not involved in this research, says childhood tuberculosis did not receive as much attention as TB in adults, in part because experts did not know how big the problem was.
This paper is an incredible addition to the field because it tells us how many children we need to be screening and targeting for preventive measures each year so that they don't go on to become sick.
Furin said preventing those kids from becoming sick also will help stop the spread of the disease, and that will help adults as well as children. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Since we're coming up on the 45th anniversary of the first moon landing, for today's Science World Quick Quiz, we want to know the name that was given to the Apollo 11's lunar lander, or LEM. Was it A, Aquarius, B, Challenger, or C, Eagle? Be thinking about it. We'll give you the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Papyrus is a light but strong reed that grows well in shallow fresh water. In this report by Faiza El-Masri, Faith Lapidus tells us how restoring the papyrus swamps could hold the key to solve many of today's problems, from pollution to water wars.
Ancient Egyptians turned papyrus into paper and provided the world with it for thousands of years. Hundreds of thousands of books in the Royal Library in Alexandria and Rome's 58 public libraries were made of papyrus, almost all of the Western world's literature and sacred texts at the time. But the value of papyrus is not limited to paper. Writer and ecologist John Gaudet says ancient scholars considered it the wonder of the age. Egyptian civilization, he adds, might not have developed without papyrus.
In the Nile Valley, to do things on a day-to-day basis, you also had to be able to get on the water. So they used to use papyrus boats. And they used papyrus boats the way people today use fiberglass. And people still make them in Ethiopia, so we know what they're like. Then they found they could also use the boats to build the houses on. They didn't have to build a house on land. They could build it on water. And then they found they could do all kinds of things with papyrus. As you can imagine, you can make baskets out of it, you can make sandals, you can make rope. They made an incredible amount of rope, and they exported the rope. So even before paper came into existence, papyrus helped the ancient Egyptian get along on a day-to-day basis.
Over the centuries, though, many papyrus swamps were drained. Gaudet says people saw them as wasted spaces that could be better used for farmland or housing. In the process, he says, an incredible natural resource was lost. In addition to the variety of items that can be manufactured from the plant, the swamps provide habitat for birds and fish and help control pollution.
Papyrus actually filtered sewage and runoff and silt all those years. And papyrus happens to be a very, very efficient plant in the filter swamp.
Gaudet says papyrus, one of the fastest growing plant species on Earth, has recently started to make a comeback. He points to several projects in Egypt to restore the swamps to filter sewage.
A lot of the scientists there, the engineers, are beginning to see the value of a filter swamp because it's cheap and it can be put in place at all different levels. You can either have a simple swamp that you don't touch. You just leave the swamp there and it works. Or you can have a managed system where you take a swamp, you take some concrete liners, you divert the polluted water into the swamp, and you clean it up that way.
In his book, Papyrus, the Plant That Changed the World, Gaudet writes that papyrus swamps may hold the key to stability in some of the most unstable regions in the world. As fresh water becomes scarcer, he says papyrus can help preserve the resource.
People always think of the wetlands and swamps as places where the water goes in, it never comes out. What I'm saying here is that the water seeps into the soil and therefore it recharges the system underground that you don't see. And also, the papyrus, because the heads close over and form this canopy and it creates this very humid barrier underneath, it's great because it actually prevents water from being lost.
Gaudet has traveled to Egypt, Sudan, Ethiopia, Uganda, and other places where papyrus grows. He works with water experts there and encourages officials to preserve papyrus swamps or restore them. He says that can benefit local economies. John Gaudet says he's optimistic. As people rediscover the benefits of papyrus, he hopes the plant will once again flourish in the land it once ruled. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Researchers say they have evidence the malaria parasite lurks in bone marrow, the spongy tissue inside bones where blood cells are produced. Carol Pearson tells us that the discovery offers hope that new treatments can be found to fight the disease.
The malaria parasite goes through a number of stages in its life cycle. After an infected mosquito bites someone, parasitic spores travel to the liver, where they grow and divide. Then they enter the bloodstream and multiply, causing the familiar symptoms of malaria: high fever, chills, sweats, fatigue, nausea, and vomiting. But there appears to be another place where immature malaria spores gather and hide: bone marrow. And once there, they can evade the body's defenses as they develop. For about 100 years, researchers have suspected a small amount of the pathogen, called Plasmodium falciparum, burrows deep inside the bones. Matt Marty specializes in malaria transmission at the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston, Massachusetts.
It was assumed that all the blood stages of the parasite are somehow sticking to the blood vessels, but these guys are not. They're outside of the blood vessels. They're in the hematopoietic system where blood is formed. And so drugs have to get there first.
But drugs have a hard time penetrating to the bone marrow, says Marty, which may explain why malaria, out of easy reach of the immune system, is difficult to treat. Investigators discovered the new reservoir of P. falciparum by studying the bone marrow of people who died of malaria. Marty says the findings may help scientists find ways to target those reservoirs during a critical stage of the parasite's life cycle.
So it will be important to find out that the current anti-malarial therapies are efficiently targeting that site, and it will be important for new drugs to be tested whether they can target that site efficiently.
Researchers report on the role of bone marrow in malaria infection in science translational medicine. For reporter Jessica Berman, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Do you have the correct answer to this week's quick quiz? Well, let's find out. A few minutes ago, we asked if you knew the name that was given to the Apollo 11's lunar lander, or LEM. Was it A, Aquarius, B, Challenger, or C, Eagle? The answer is C. The Eagle was the name of Apollo 11's Lunar Excursion Module, or LEM. Remember when mission commander and first man on the moon, Neil Armstrong, announced that they had safely landed on the moon?
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
By the way, answer A, Aquarius, was the name of the ill-fated Apollo 13's lander. While it never touched down on the moon, it did play a major role in getting the mission's astronauts home safely. Answer B, Challenger, was the lander used by the Apollo 17, the last Apollo landing mission. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet, voanews.com/science.
A number of studies about climate change involves discussion from a purely technical and scientific standpoint about the various mechanics of climate change, such as rising carbon dioxide levels, melting polar ice, or rising sea levels. But when scientists release a new report that actually demonstrates the negative effects climate change is having or will have on real living creatures, discussion of this still controversial subject seems to take on new meaning. A new long-term study recently published by the journal Nature is linking climate change with marine life along the rapidly warming West Antarctic Peninsula. The paper discloses how factors such as fluctuations in wind speed and sea ice cover can set off a chain of events up through the local food chain, impacting all living creatures from single-cell algae to penguins. Dr. Grace Saba, an assistant research professor at Rutgers University's Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences, is the lead author of this new study. She joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about her team's research and the impact climate change is having and will have on marine life in the West Antarctic Peninsula. Can you please tell us about this study and what your team found after conducting all the research?
So this study is a product of the Palmer Long-Term Ecological Research Project that has been going on in the West Antarctic Peninsula region since about 1991. They go down there for annual sampling. So there's a cruise that goes down every January, And then there's people that stay on Palmer Station during the summer field season, which in Antarctica, it's about October through April. And this is the first study that has looked at the data from the Palmer Station region. So we were looking at changes in phytoplankton, so the small, tiny, drifting plants that krill and all the other zooplankton eat. And krill, as you know, are a major source of food for other organisms, higher-level organisms such as penguins and whales. And so we look at these organisms, and we also look at the physical environment and as well as the chemical environment. So we're looking at nutrients, too, that phytoplankton need. And so from this data, this long-term data, we've been able to look at patterns in the way that the system responds every year. So that we call this interannual variability. So we're able to see now how tightly tied the biology, so the food web, the phytoplankton, the krill, and the penguins, how tightly linked the biology is to the physics of the environment, so the sea ice, how stable the water column is. So some phytoplankton, like the big diatoms that the krill like, they don't really like to be mixed a lot in the water column. So when there's really windy days, the water column, it's mixed deeper, and so there's less light in the deeper part of the ocean. And so we're able to see these links now between the physics and the biology, which is something that you can't really do on a year-by-year basis. You need to look at long-term data to be able to see these interannual cycles.
And finally, Dr. Saba, based on your team's research, what do you think the outlook for Antarctica's marine life is?
So the West Antarctic Peninsula specifically is where we work, and that's where we've seen the increase in temperatures, and that's where we've seen a huge reduction in sea ice. There are other regions of Antarctica that actually have increase of sea ice, such as the Ross Sea, which is farther south. But specifically speaking of the West Antarctic Peninsula, we've seen major changes in the far northern part of the peninsula. So there's been some previous work done by other groups that have looked at declines in chlorophyll, which is a pigment that phytoplankton have. That's how we measure phytoplankton. So we've seen this decline in the phytoplankton biomass in the far northern reaches of the peninsula. And we've also seen declines of Antarctic krill in the region, too. And we kind of think that this is from the decline in phytoplankton in that region. It could be other reasons as well, like the whales coming back from their near extinction in the region from the whaling long ago. But there's been some major biological shifts in the region, but this could also be tied to the changes in the physical environment. So we've seen a pretty much complete loss of sea ice in the far northern region of Antarctica. It's warming. Now that there's more less ice, there's a more open water. And so what's happening is the wind will mix the water more, and so we have these deeper mixed layers in the far northern parts of the peninsula, which means that there's less light for phytoplankton. So we've seen shifts in communities of phytoplankton to phytoplankton that tolerate lower light levels better. And some of these phytoplankton, they're called cryptophytes. They're small cells, and the krill can't efficiently feed on them. So there's a lot of things that are happening, and we're worried that if the temperature keeps rising, the processes that are occurring now in the far northern reaches of the peninsula are going to begin migrating southward as the ice melts.
That was Dr. Grace Saba from Rutgers University's Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences in New Brunswick, New Jersey. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.